had no one in the room, so it's nice to have you here. And what we do is Mike Abramowitz of the Washington Post is a White House correspondent, and are going to talk about White House communications and about how he covers the White House. This is for a course on White House communications, which is a course at Towson University, and the students at Towson are hooked in here, you can see on the monitor. And then what we usually do is do about 45 minutes to an hour of our interview, and then you all come in with questions. And so we'll go to you all to have some questions in addition to the students back at Towson. Well, welcome, Mike. It's nice to have you here. It's nice to have an audience here as well. Can you tell us, one of the things I guess we always like to know is how people got to the White House, because most of the people who come to the White House as correspondents have worked a lot of places beforehand, that the people who come to the White House are experts in a lot of different ways, and have proved their bona fides in a lot of different ways. So how did you get to the White House?
Well, my story is a bit conventional and a bit unconventional, I would say. I basically worked at the Washington Post since I was a summer intern. I started off as a summer intern after college on the business section of the Post, and I basically worked throughout the paper, both on business, on our Metro desk, and for the last 10 years or so on our national desk. And I've covered a lot of different things, but I would say that the focus of my work at the Post has been government and politics, at all levels. I've covered county government. I covered Prince George's County government for the Post. I've covered city government. I covered the mayor of Washington, D.C., Marion Barry, when he was mayor the first time around.
Okay. I've covered state government. I was the Annapolis State House reporter for 3 years, and then I've covered national government in the White House and Congress to a lesser extent. And that's actually a very familiar type of background, I think, for a lot of people who cover the White House. Most of my colleagues have covered different levels of American government to one degree or another. The one area where I'm a little bit different, I think, than some of my colleagues, is that I actually was an editor for about 8 or 9 years. And so I actually came to the White House beat having been an editor. I had been our congressional editor at the Washington Post, supervising our congressional reporters, and then for 6 years I was our national editor, which basically meant supervising the reporters who cover national affairs, which includes politics and the White House. And I always like to say that I pulled a Cheney, because we had an opening for a White House reporter, and I nominated myself. And so I kind of preempted the competition. That's the story of how I got here.
Oh, that's interesting. Terry Hunt had something of a similar background, because he, too, spent time editing. What did you get from all the various places you've been that help you cover the White House?
Well, I would say I think the biggest thing that's helpful is just a sense of how to cover a beat. And how to cover, especially a news beat, in which you're kind of at a place like the Washington Post, where you're juggling the necessity of covering breaking news, press conferences, announcements, but you also have a desire to find stories that no one else has. And the way you do that, to me, is very similar at all levels of the reporting that I've done. You try to get sourced up with officials inside of government, and also people outside of government, and you try to triangulate, getting pieces of information from unofficial sources, and then trying to get it confirmed from official sources. And I think the whole process of covering a beat has been a very useful experience for me as I've covered the White House, because, as you know, it's a very impenetrable fortress. at first glance, and and even 2 years into it, it's very difficult to get information. So part of what myself and my colleague, like Peter Baker, who I know has been to your class before, we're just constantly thinking of, you know, how to get uh-huh. information unofficially.
Uh-huh. In a way, you could say it's ever thus. William Price, who covered the White House for the Evening Star at the turn of the 20th century, wrote about the difficulty of getting information out of the White House when Theodore Roosevelt was president. And he said, the White House doesn't give you news, you have to find it. He said, it's like you have to be like a miner and dig. And so he said that where he digs is he went up on the hill, and then he talked to people in agencies and departments. That was the way he had to cover the White House.
You know, that's interesting, because I think that's still a very good lesson for how to do things. You know, sometimes you'll get lucky and you'll get a source inside the White House who's talking to you unofficially and giving you information that may not be the official information. But that's really quite rare. And uh-huh. I think what's more common is finding sources, as you say, on the Hill, in agencies, in K Street, in the K Street community, in the think tank land. You know, people who come into contact right. with the White House, they pick up things, and then hopefully they'll tell you about them.
Uh-huh. Are a lot of people that you talk to, people that you've known before the beat, before you got on the White House beat, that you knew from reporting or from editing?
You know, some. It's just a mixture of people. I've lived in Washington for really my whole life. I actually grew up in Washington. My father was a government official, mm-hmm. a bureaucrat. And so when you live in Washington, when you're at the Washington Post, you know, you collect a lot of acquaintances mm-hmm. Over the years. And yes, you know, your best sources are often people that you've known, you know, before.
Yeah.
It's very hard, I think, but not impossible, to find people instantly and have them be willing to reveal sensitive information yeah. to you. I mean, I think that a great lesson in this is actually my colleague Bob Woodward, who's basically, I think you could argue, has been covering the presidency, although in a different way than I do, uh-huh. you know, for 30 years. And Bob has collected lots of sources, and people who were sources of his when he was covering the Nixon and Ford administrations have, you know, come back.
Yeah.
I don't have any inside information about who Bob's sources are, but mm-hmm. it's clear that he has been working Washington for a long time, and I think that's a lesson of how this is a process. And I think that the most successful, that many of the most successful Washington reporters, White House reporters, are people who have had that kind of longevity uh-huh. to be able to get sources. Of course, then you have the opposite problem of occasionally maybe being co-opted because you're so close to the story.
Right.
But those are the things you have to balance.
Uh-huh. There are a couple of people who started in Washington a long time ago, one who's still in Washington and one who isn't. Jim Deacon covered the White House for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he covered Eisenhower administration through, I guess he was into maybe Reagan, I think probably through Reagan. And he said that when he came to town, that you often would meet with people in government. And as young reporters meeting young officials, Walter Pincus talked about that too. He said there were a whole group of them that would meet, that they saw a mutual need to understand one another. And so they met with people who were just starting out in government. And those people have become very useful over the years.
Well, those are the best kinds of sources. I mean, people that people that you've met when they were an assistant to a congressman, you know, some low-level job, you know, in their 20s, and then end up being a cabinet secretary in 20 or 30 years. I mean, one of the interesting things about covering the White House now is that you try to imagine, you know, who are the future Dick Cheney's, of course, Cheney kind of started at a high level, but you know, he was a he was a low-level staffer at one point, and he and then he
for Rumsfeld,
right? And then he, and then he moved up.
Do you think that there's any of that sense that existed then that that there is a mutual interest in understanding one another? Do you think that that there are groups of reporters and officials that get together with that kind of idea to get an idea of what their interests are and what they can learn about the other?
Not in the kind of formal way you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know this for a fact, but I would guess that Washington has changed a little bit over the last 30 years from when Walter was starting out.
Right.
I think that there is less of that kind of comity than you would imagine, more our side versus their side. I think that you can get that kind of comity on a one-to-one basis occasionally, and I think if you're wise and you work in the administration and you're a young official starting out, it would behoove you to get to know some reporters, if only to know how we think, and vice versa.
Right.
But I'm not sure a lot of people really think that way right now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When you look at the coverage of your coverage of the state, at the state level, and the kinds of things you were looking for, do you find that there is continuity? You were talking about some of the things that you were looking for, that there was continuity there. Do you think that that has continued, even though there's so many different ways now of gathering information? Does the story really remain the same no matter how much information there now is, or how often you have to report? That, let's say with the presidency, that you're really looking for the same kinds of things. I mean, you could go back to William Price and say, to some extent, the things that William Price was looking for were somewhat similar to what people are looking for today. What the president says, what where he gets an idea, what he wants to do with it, what do the critics say?
I think so. I mean, I think that I personally am interested in two or three major kinds of stories that are I would say, kind of eternal in a way, no matter what level of government you're focused on. I mean, one is accountability stories, you know, measuring mayor, governor, president against his or her words, promises, seeing how they measure up. I think that's a sort of a standard type of story that I'm interested in. I also think the explanation of how government works, how decisions are made, I find those types of stories really interesting. I enjoy reading books about that subject. I enjoy reading well-done articles about that. And that is a focus of you know, what I try to do sometimes. I mean, it's hard when you're covering the White House, especially at a place like the Washington Post, that there's such a flood of news. And the Washington Post is one of really only a few newspapers remaining that cover, that takes the kind of day-to-day coverage of covering the White House seriously. I mean, you would know this better than I do, but I think a lot of newspapers have kind of moved to a more episodic coverage of the White House. We go on every domestic trip with the president. We go on every foreign trip with the president. You know, basically, we want to write a news story about most things that the president does. And so there is a sort of I wouldn't call it stenography, because I think it's more than stenography.
Right.
We're providing more than just, you know, we're providing analysis, context. But there's a lot that the president does on a day-to-day basis that, that we feel we have to cover that other news organizations don't necessarily cover. So that leaves a little bit of less time to do the kinds of stories that I just mentioned. And one, you know, you're always struggling for the right balance, and one could argue that we don't do enough of those types of stories, and that we would be better off focusing more on those kinds of stories, accountability, explanatory, and less on the news stories. But that's really a balancing act that never goes away.
The news stories are central, right?
Exactly.
Because even if it's on, you know, say that even if it's on the internet or it's on CNN, it still has to be in the paper because your paper is a record.
That's right.
Is that something that you all talk about, the importance of having the Post as a record of what's happened?
Do you know something that's interesting? It's not something that we talk about formally, and I think different people have to bring different sensibilities to that. You know, like a lot of big institutions, traditions are kind of passed on, you know, subtly without a formal, hey, here's how we do things. But I think Peter and I and our new colleague, Dan Egan, who's moved over from the Justice Department to help cover the White House, you know, we are very much fans of people who came before us, people like Lou Cannon and Devroy, who were sort of legends, and I think we see ourselves in that tradition, and that tradition was chronicling, you know, day-to-day story of the important events out of the White House.
Can you tell us how difficult is it to do an accountability story, and take it at the state level and at the city level and then at the national level? Is it any different? Gathering the information, is it more difficult in one place or another? And can you give us some examples of some of those kinds of stories?
I'm trying to decide whether it's more difficult or... I find the process very similar on all levels. You know, one of the pieces I was most proud of when I covered the governor in Maryland was a set of pieces I did about a pension scandal that took place when Paris Glendening, who was a newly elected Democratic governor in 1994, he basically set up a kind of a slippery system in which he and his top aides were given elevated pensions beyond what they would normally be entitled to because they were, quote-unquote, involuntarily separated from their jobs. I mean, he ran for governor. He decided to leave the job. Yeah. So I exposed that, and I basically, I mean, that one was sort of easier. It was a tip from a good source who said, hey, you ought to look into this. And it was someone I had been kind of cultivating over the course of several years. And so that's a classic example of how accountability is done. Right. You know, I think it's for me, it's been more difficult at the White House, partially because I had not been a reporter for a while and my sources were not as extensive. It takes me a while to, you know, get to know people again. Yeah. I mean, even though you do get to know people as an editor, you're still a little bit divorced from the, you know, from the gritty day-to-day elements of beat reporting. I mean, what you try to do with, I think, with the president is, you know, look at statements, promises, and compare the reality. I mean, one of the pieces I was again proud of last year is I did an extensive amount of reporting on Darfur. And which has been a kind of a cause for the president, right. And I spent several months trying to sort of look into why it had been so difficult for the president to actually deliver on his promises to end the genocide in Darfur, and you know, that piece took a lot of reporting around the White House, people who'd been in the State Department, people who'd been at the Pentagon. People in the advocacy NGO nonprofit community, and you it's an additive process. You gradually get information, but it's slow, and you have to basically be willing to keep going with it and not. You could easily spend your whole day, your whole year just writing day stories coming out of the White House, and you got to try to resist that a bit.
How long did that story take you to put together?
That story took a long time. I would say I had that idea for to do that story in, say, March or April of 07, and the piece didn't run until November, I think, the fall of 07. And part of it, there was just some internal difficulties at the Post in the sense of we had some transitions with editors and had a hard time actually getting people to actually edit the story once I turned it in. So part of it was not, but the reporting took a while. And if you want, and if you want to have really good interviews, I often think you want to do them in person. You don't want to just do them over the phone, and that takes some time to go see people in person and get them to open up with you, get them to open up to you.
So do you usually have how many stories do you have running at the same time? Like if you're doing a daily story, do you usually have an enterprise story that you're working on at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that might be useful is to tell you a little bit about how we structure things at the Post. As I said, we have three White House reporters, which is relatively unusual, especially in the eighth year of an administration. I think we're the only people who have three people covering the White House now, which is good because I think what Bush is doing is still interesting. There's a lot of travel. It just is much easier. It frees us all up to do not only day stories but also this enterprise. What we basically do is that each week, one of us is responsible for the whatever the breaking news out of the White House, and so that means we'll go to the briefings. We will, if there's if the president gives a major speech, if the president has some major initiative on Capitol Hill. That's your responsibility for the week. And so you really kind of, that week, you kind of assume you're not going to have a lot of time to do these other types of stories that I'm talking about, these more enterprising stories. But you basically, at any time, I have, like, I try to have at least three or four different, you know, ideas cooking. You know, maybe a couple that are sort of more short-term. And then I always like to have, you know, one, you know, more major piece that's really a substantial investment of time and resources and attention working at one time, because you know those are pieces that just takes a while to kind of chip away at, and you can't, and if you just can't just do it all in like 1 week, and especially if you're trying to arrange interviews that are difficult to get to, it can take a while. So I always am juggling three or four different stories.
And so when you're doing the day-to-day, the breaking news, what are Peter and Dan doing?
They're usually working on their enterprise
stories. On their enterprise,
But because the White House is such a news-driven beat, you often find that you're pulled into daily stuff, too. So, for instance, this week is a State of the Union. Not this week, but, you know. And so one person can't cover that. You got to have, you know, we're all trying to figure out what might be in the State of the Union. The night of the State of the Union, there'll be a main news story. You'll probably want some kind of analysis. So oftentimes, you're sort of drawn into daily news, even though it's your week to work on enterprise.
At the beginning of this administration, or somewhat into it, did you all ever think, with our discussions at the Post, about covering the White House, this White House, in a different way because of the role of the Vice President? Because it seemed that most news organizations have not really covered the Vice President. You all did a major story that that Joe Becker worked on, and Barton Gellman, and that I guess they must have worked on for a year and a half or so.
Yes. Actually, I was involved with that piece in the conception. I was an editor. I was actually one of the editors that assigned Joe and Bart to the piece. And it's interesting about that, just as a segue, that piece has actually been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and I believe it's a finalist. It was an extraordinary piece of work, I thought, about the presidency, which I would recommend to your students. But it's funny, because Bart Gellman, who's one of our best investigative reporters, I had actually been trying to interest him in Cheney for a long time, and you know, even sort of early in the administration. And he's very clever about sourcing. He just really felt that it was going to be hard to kind of break something fresh and original about Cheney, which is something that I think investigative reporters are thinking about all the time. How can I bring value added? But he came to us, to my boss, Liz Spade, and, you know, about a year later from the initial conversation, well, you know, now I think, because what happens over the course of the administration is that people leave the administration, people who you couldn't get to to interview them about the vice president are suddenly now available to be interviewed. So I think he, in his mind, thought that it was easier to report, you know, a little bit further into the administration, which I think actually raised. I think it's very difficult to do real time, you know, inside TikToks of like, you know, editors. It's kind of funny because now I have a perspective of being both an editor and a reporter. Yeah. I know a lot of times editors insist on things which are very difficult to do. And I think one of the things that's just very difficult to do is kind of the instant TikTok, where you try to, you know, the president makes a decision on, I'm just trying to think of what would be a good example. You know, the president makes, you know, unveils his a major plan on Social Security. And the instant idea of an editor is, oh, let's tell the story of how he constructed this idea. And I think it's really can take, you know, I think it can really take a while, you know, sometimes years.
Yeah.
When you can really have a better sense of what really happened in that. Because in the initial flush of this, even though you have to do these stories to a certain extent, a lot of what comes out of the White House and the people who they deploy to kind of tell you about this is fairly self-interested, and I think it takes a little distance to get away from these events to have a better sense of what really of what really happened. But anyway, I think going back to your, I got off your original point. I think in retrospect, it probably would have been wise for the Post to have maybe told one of the three White House reporters at the time, you focus on Cheney. Mm-hmm. I think in retrospect that might have been a useful division of labors, given how important he was, especially in the first term.
Yeah.
Less so, I think, in the second term. Uh-huh. He seems to have been a bit marginalized is not the right word, but he certainly, all evidence is that he's not quite the powerful, he's not quite the figure that I think he was in the first term. But again, I think that's going to take some historians to figure that out, too.
Yeah. And I had a discussion with Ann Devroy about covering Hillary Clinton and why she hadn't spent time covering her. And so she said she thought early on, in part, it was a fear that she would get stuck. Doing, you know, the woman's beat. That's
yes.
Going back to an older time. One of the things that she said that she did was that she acted as a traffic cop for all Post stories that were coming into the White House, which Mike McCurry said was very useful because there were so many different reporters from the Post working on stories that at one time or another would involve the White House. Do you all have that kind of, is that kind of an operation?
You know, that's a really interesting issue to discuss because Devroy was famously protective of the beat and basically did not want any other reporter talking to people in the White House without her brokering it. And so if you're covering foreign policy, for instance, this can create a problem, since many of the people who are influential in foreign policy are on the National Security Council. And so I think that created a lot of internal friction in the Post. I wasn't on National at the time, but I know for a fact that it did create a lot of friction from time to time. Peter and I, and I think we're more relaxed about that. You know, I think it's just there is so much stuff going on that it is. I just think it's fruitless to try to be a complete control
and to be the traffic cop.
And to be the traffic cop. I mean, I would not like it if someone not on the beat, you know, tried to have an interview with the chief of staff or the national security advisor, or you know, a major figure in the White House. Without, you know, at least checking it with me, and I would raise a fuss about that. But if the State Department reporter, for instance, who covers, you know, North Korea intensively, has a relationship with the person who handles North Korea on the National Security Council. It doesn't really bother me. It's just more than enough stuff. We actually had an interesting experience. The White House has tried in the last year to reach out to other reporters beyond the White House press pool to give the president access to. For instance, the president has been peddling some ideas on health care, health savings accounts, some other things. And so one day the press office called me and said, by the way, the president is going to going to Landover tomorrow. He's going to be giving a talk on health savings accounts. He's going to be meeting with some business people in Landover to talk about his ideas on health care. And by the way, I'm going to invite the health care reporter for the Post to sit in on this, and we might give him 10 minutes with the president. And, you know, that kind of gave me pause, because, you know, we've been like... We've been basically, we have a standing interview request to talk with the president. The last time we had an interview with the president was in December 06. So that didn't really make me too happy, but I'm not going to turn down an interview with the president. I'm not over, I suppose, you know, Fox, you know, NPR, I think, is this right, Martha, they turned down an interview because... They wanted to do with
right,
Juan Williams.
Juan Williams, right.
Right, as opposed to someone at NPR would choose.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are definitely issues that you don't want the White House to be dictating, but the reporter could ask anything he wanted, and so I think Peter and I talked about it, and we just felt like we'd rather have the interview than not. And so, I don't think Devroy would have permitted that.
or she would have become the health reporter.
Or she would have become the health reporter, exactly.
Pretty quickly.
Right.
Do you find that one of the benefits of being an editor was that you learned a lot of substantive policies, so that you learned about issues that are all over the government? Say, for example, you'd learned economics, and you learned a lot about foreign policy. And that when you come to the White House, one of the advantages of being an editor is that you've worked in all of those different areas, and so you're better equipped to use them as threads to pull in a White House. Because White Houses, I mean, this one is more locked up than most are.
Right.
But if you have a specialty and you can zero in on that, you can find out how decisions are made, so you could get to the decision-making.
Right. Well, I definitely agree with you that having one or two specialties, I think, is very useful. So, for instance, if you know a lot about economics, if you know a lot about foreign policy, those are two subjects that are really good to know about covering the White House, because those are just the bread and butter of what the president does every day. And if you, for instance, come into the job with a lot of substantive expertise about foreign policy, with a lot of contacts in that world, you're going to be better off. Now, I think being an editor, to be honest, I did not develop that kind of substantive expertise in one particular area. I tended to know a little about a lot of different things, which is good in terms of covering the White House, because, you know, every week you might have to cover five different things, and it's always useful to say, hey, I know this about trade, or I know this about or I know this about healthcare. But actually, I've always felt that I wish I had some more substantive expertise in some of these areas. I think I would be doing a better job if I did have some of that expertise. Just on being an editor, I mean, I think the thing actually about being an editor that is helpful is not necessarily substantive expertise, but it's basically an ability to think analytically about what makes a good story and what doesn't make a good story, what will, you know, what are the elements of a story that you need to get that would make it a front page story? I think all reporters would benefit from being an editor for a certain period of time because it causes you to think, I think, more rigorously about mm-hmm. about what makes a good story.
What do you see as a front page story? What are the elements?
Well, it's changed a lot, I think, over the years.
Yeah.
I think that when I first came to work at the Washington Post in the mid-'80s, there was a lot of really incremental news that would be on the front page. I think there were more stories on the front page, actually. I think there might have been 8 or 9 stories on the front page. Now we only have 6 tops. Mm-hmm. And I think now they're looking for things that are more synthetic in a way, mm-hmm. not man-made, but that kind of synthesize, that pull things together. I mean, I think the key, I think newsiness, having things that other people don't have, that's a critical element to a front page story. I think in many ways that's the most important thing mm-hmm. that we do. You know, finding out information that other people don't have. Uh-huh. Whether it's like an analytical scoop or whether it's a substantive scoop, to me that's the biggest element. I think that whenever you get that, you have a better shot of having a front page story uh-huh. than not.
Uh-huh. When you're talking about it's being synthetic, it seems that one of the problems today is there's an enormous amount of information, but there's a lack of understanding. And so how do you bring the understanding? How do you help people sift and decide what is news and what isn't?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think the rise of the Internet has really challenged traditional news organizations like the Washington Post, because basically the odds are that by the time the morning Washington Post winds up on the doorstep of your readers, of your dwindling number of readers who actually receive the hard copy.
You have more readers. It's just that they read in the Internet.
Exactly. But my only point is that, like, a presidential press conference, to take one example, Bush tends to have his press conferences in the mornings, you know, around 10 o'clock in the morning. By next morning's paper, mm-hmm. it's too late to kind of just do a straight news story about that press conference, quite frankly, because most people will have read it already in some form or another. So what you end up doing is you'll come back to the paper after the news conference and you'll do an immediate story mm-hmm. for the web. And then you will kind of think and cogitate and discuss with your colleagues, the editors, what value added can you bring for the next day? What kind of analytical points or what kind of context is there to make? And that's what you're trying to do over the next 4 or 5 hours as you write for the next morning's paper.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wondered as an editor was whether you heard from the White House. Did the White House call you and complain about stories? And if so, what kinds of stories would they complain about, and what happens with that? And have you had that experience with this White House or any other?
You know, it's kind of interesting. As an editor, I didn't hear too much from the White House. I think that the White House press office, I don't have a scientific sense of this, but I think they really go to the reporters if they're unhappy with a story.
Uh-huh.
And they'll go to reporters with varying degrees of heavy-handedness. There are some people in the White House who kind of have, over the years, kind of accepted the fact that they're not going to like a lot of the stuff that's in the paper. They'll kind of send you a note if they really don't like something and uh-huh. just, but it kind of rolls off them. And there are others who are more combative about it and wanting to really get in your face and threaten you.
Did you get a sense that when you get something like you know, you get a hair fire, is that because the president has directed them to do so? Do you get any sense of where the president comes into it?
My sense is that most of the complaining comes from people below the president. I've heard on one or two occasions that, not necessarily myself, but you know, the president, you know, was pissed off about something. Mm-hmm. Excuse the French, but I have a sense that the president, I don't think the president gets too hot and bothered about stuff like that. I mean, he seems to have a fairly thick hide, and I think that the people who get angry about coverage are below him. Mm-hmm. That's just my sense. I don't have I don't have an empirical database to draw upon.
I guess you hope you don't either.
Yes. Well, you know. If you're doing your job, I think you're going to end up writing things that they're not happy about. And your job is not really to write about things to make them happy about. I mean, you want to be fair, too. And so.
How many stories would you write, say, in a week? What are the rhythms of your day and the rhythms of a week?
It really can depend. You know, when you're on a president, like when I went to the Middle East with the president in January, that was an 8 or 9 day trip. That was like really exhausting. Wrote a story every day, basically I wrote every story, you know, twice really, you know, once for the web, and then because you're 7 or 8 hours ahead of Washington, so basically by the end of your working day, it's people are getting up in Washington, and so you can file for the web, and then you have to you know, do something again more analytical, more contextual for the paper the next day. Then, you know, the bane of our existence are these blogs, and you know, like a lot of newspapers, we've started a lot of blogs, and we have this something we call On the Plane, which is which is actually fun to do, but it's a lot of work. It adds to your work. You try to give a little slice of what it's like to be traveling with the president, and so you file for that too. So you know, if you're traveling, if you're on the news in a busy news time, if you're traveling, you can end up writing every day. This week, my colleague Peter is with Bush in NATO. Bush has gone to Europe for the NATO summit. Things are a little more quiet in Washington. I've been working on a piece that will run this weekend, setting up next week's hearings with Petraeus and Crocker, and I've had some more time to develop that story. So. I don't expect really to have another story this week. I may if news happens, but I'm really focusing on that story.
And one of the things that you have to do on a trip too is you have to write pool reports. And so, in addition to your own writing,
that's right,
you're writing for all of the colleagues that are on the press list.
Right. That's usually not that much of a burden. Mm-hmm. I mean. It's actually interesting. I mean, your students may not. I mean, like when you go on a presidential trip, a lot of the time you're sort of in a filing center because you know you can't get really near the president. A small group of reporters gets to sort of go with the president to each of his meetings. That's the pool that you're alluding to. So, especially on foreign trips, it's fun to be in the pool because you actually get to see things. You know, for instance, on the trip to the Middle East. One of the great pool assignments, which I did not get to do, was to be with Bush when he went to go to the ranch owned by the king of Saudi Arabia,
and
saw the horses that he had, and you really saw something that most average people would not get to see. There was another day in which Bush also did a lot of sightseeing in Israel, where I think he went to the Church of the Nativity, he went to the I think he went to the Western Wall. He went to a couple different sites, and And to go with a president on that kind of sightseeing tour is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. It also means you have to spend a lot of that day writing up, as you suggest, pool reports for your colleagues.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to questions now. And Towson, you can start. Somebody have a question? Yep. Hey. Front row.
Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. With the rise of the internet, the role of a harder copy newspaper is obviously having to change a little bit. How do you see papers being able to function in an increasingly internet-based age, whether they become places where only shorter pieces are or longer pieces, or do you think maybe eventually the newspaper will just not even exist because it isn't relevant anymore?
If I knew the answer to that question, I'd be the publisher of the Washington Post, because that's like the existential question for my business. They're trying to figure that out. You're totally right about your analysis. As best as I can tell, people under 40 basically don't read. Get most of their information on the internet, and so they'll come to our website. But they don't have to pay for it. So it's created quite a kind of a business conundrum, because I still see that what I do as quite valuable to people, but because I think, as you suggested, that there are a lot of people still read, who want to read what we have. But not a lot of people who are doing actual reporting about what's going on in the White House or on politics or so forth. But it costs money to fund that operation.
Yeah, the difficulty is how to make it happen.
And
it
we haven't
possible.
Quite figured out how to monetize that yet.
Last year I was doing a piece that was on Eisenhower and television. I went back to look at the beginnings of television and the coverage of the presidency, and I ran across a quote from a guy at NBC, and it was in the 1940s. And he said he couldn't imagine that anybody would watch ads if you put ads on television. And he didn't know how they could make television work and pay for itself. And so I wondered if that's not going to be this case. That we go. I mean, I look at that and you just laugh. Now, maybe, 30 years down the road, it's going to be the same kinds of thing, that there's going to be a way of making it pay. You can certainly see that in the internet, everyone depends upon newspapers and the wires, no matter what kind of website they've got.
Right.
That is, that's where the news comes from.
Well, right, and I think you raised a good question for us, which I was trying to get at in my answer earlier about, it's not enough for us just to cover the news. I mean, we can't. If I just wrote a news story about the presidential press conference at 10 o'clock in the morning, it would not be. We'd be going out of business even faster than we seem to be going out of business now. I mean, we're constantly trying to think of ways to be relevant to readers, and so therefore you see blogs, you see a little bit more attitude on the part of reporters, to try to write with a voice for the web that you might not get away with if you're writing for the paper. And I think, I'm not saying that's a good thing, I'm not saying it's a bad thing either. It's interesting, I don't know, Martha, if you've studied this, but one of our most popular features on the internet is Dan Frumkin.
Right.
Who, for those of you who don't know, is basically a blogger who writes a very popular column for us in which he kind of aggregates a lot of the daily press coverage of the White House and then kind of infuses it with his own kind of editorial judgment and spin and so forth. Dan is a very smart guy, and he has a very good nose for news, but it's not... He doesn't write in a way that I think Peter and I would feel comfortable doing, because we see ourselves in a different role.
And it was a subject of some discussion.
Yes.
I mean, public discussion at the Post.
Right. And I think the way it's been worked out is appropriate, which is that Dan's column is now labeled opinion. because I really don't think it's, although he may disagree, I don't know, I've never really talked about it, but I don't think you could consider it like straight news in the way that what we do. And you know, people say to us, well, what you do, straight news, that's not useful because you're just like letting the president say what, get away with lies.
Do editors go over what goes on to a blog? Let's say with Dan's, does anybody go over that, or is that, does he have total control over that, or does the online Washington Post go over it?
Everything is supposed to be edited before it goes on. I think the reality is that I think there's less editing on blogs.
Yeah.
You know, we, for instance, have started a campaign blog called The Trail. I don't know if you've noticed that, where a lot of breaking news and analysis we post right onto this blog, and it's actually gotten a lot of traffic, and I think people like it, but they don't have the same kind of editing that you would with a story that I do, you know, for the paper. We also, I lost my train of thought, but there is we also have chats too. Mm-hmm. That's also a minefield. Mm-hmm. It's because there's a desire for a lot of kind of interaction with readers, and I think those are very popular features. Every other week, Peter and I alternate doing a weekly chat about what's going on at the White House, and I actually enjoy that, answering questions, but you can really, you know, it's from your typewriter right onto the internet, so you got to really, you don't have an editor backstopping you, and so it's not, you really have to think twice before you post things. At least I do.
When you said that that if you were to write about the press conference the next day, about what happened in the press conference, that wouldn't be so useful because people already know it. How do you know that people know that, that they actually have followed it? Is that an assumption you all make?
That's an assumption. You know, that's a fair point. That's an assumption that we make. I am certain that there is a sizable, that there is a cohort of people who basically still get the print paper and basically have that as their primary source of news. But my sense is, we've done market surveys about that. I can't cite it off the top of my head, but I think that over the last 15 or 20 years, it's indisputable that people get their information from other sources. It's just been a proliferation of different sources of news. And I think, I just assume that by the next morning, it's going to be 24 hours after the event almost, and that people are going to have a basic knowledge of what happened at that event. Mm-hmm. So I need to do something different. I need to provide some context or analysis that they would not otherwise get. Now, this, by the way, is interesting. This kind of really annoys the White House because they just want straight news.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've actually had this kind of conversation with people in the press shop that, you know, they'll go the next day and they'll see that my story about the press conference, you know, that I'll have written a story about the press conference immediately, but then for the paper, you know, I'll pick one particular thing that I find kind of interesting and focus on that, do some extra reporting. So it doesn't provide necessarily a complete picture of what happened at the press conference.
And it may be something like, say, in that last solo press conference where Peter Mayer asked him about the price of gasoline going up to $4 a gallon. And that experts say that, and he mocked that. The president mocked that.
Or he seemed not. He seemed not to know about
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
My colleague Dana Milbank, who writes the sketch, actually focused on that, and I focused on the question about dealing with tyrants. Because remember, Bush was kind of at that press conference, was kind of weighing in. Even though he said he didn't want to be the pundit-in-chief, he was kind of weighing in a bit on some of the issues that had kind of been cropping up on the Democratic campaign, and particularly this idea that Obama had espoused, that we should be sitting down with our adversaries, and so Bush kind of riffed on that.
Yeah. How many of you all read a newspaper most, say, several times a week. And that's a hard copy of a newspaper. Yeah, hard copy of a newspaper, including Sunday.
Does anyone actually subscribe to a hard copy of a newspaper? That's a magazine.
Yeah. Like
So one person, that's depressing.
I can home deliver your book, the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Yeah, that do.
Yeah, but you see, you're over 40. So yeah, yeah. You don't count. I same thing with me, but I'm over 40. I want people under 40 getting the newspaper.
How many of you all read online? Read a newspaper online? And how many newspapers do you read online? Do you read several? Do you read them from not just the U.S., but read abroad? Okay. Towson, how many of you all subscribe to a newspaper? Okay. There. Got somebody there. How many of you all will read a hard copy of a paper a few days a week? Yeah, so there's several.
Can I ask one other question? I'm kind of curious, how many people here, you know, will get their news from some kind of aggregator, you know, something like
Drudge?
Or either Drudge would be one example, or, you know, what I've done, like I create my own, you know, through Yahoo, my own feeds, you know, so I can basically have a quick look at what's in all the different, I mean, I'm just kind of curious. Or Facebook, I guess, has some. Don't they have some app? I haven't looked at that. Someone was telling me today that there's.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. It's one I haven't used. Put it in the Slate. Well, Slate's part of yours. At the White House, I talked to somebody who was saying that was one of the things they did each morning was look at Slate, and they print that out. Because I was asking about...
This is a person who works at the White House.
Yes, who's a senior person at the White House. And
why was this person reading Slate?
Because one of the things he wanted to look at is a synthesis of news.
Uh-huh. They have a synthesis, column.
Right.
So like the summaries of what's in the Post, the Times, and the LA Times, the major papers.
Yeah, and they looked at that. If you look at the White House news summary... It's like, you know, it's gotten to be like that. I can't imagine how anybody could deal with that. It's just impossible. Okay, let's get a question here. Yeah.
My question had two parts to it. Last night in a forum, I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the person who was speaking last night, but one question had come up about, you know, news as a public good and the possibility of, you know, if the market fails, if there's a market failure for news and, you know, not having the audience for hard copy news. One question came up about possibly kind of indirect government subsidies coming in there, even though, I mean, the idea of government and news, I mean, that's a killer, but it had come up since it is a public good. So that's one question. The other one isn't really related, but it does tag on to the last question. On this one, I'm actually more interested in the second one, and that is, you know, what about, you know, I don't know how Yahoo News works. I know Google News pulls in, you know, from a myriad of sources, but what, I mean, has there been thoughts entertained in regards to, you know, these search engines that obviously their primary business isn't necessarily news, but they clearly, I mean, it seems clear enough that they have the funding and means to maybe, you know, dive into the news business. I mean, is that something that comes up in discussions? Is possibly maybe that being the future of news?
Two questions. First one, I think this is not a trend you asked about directly, but I do think it's interesting that kind of the NPR model, which is I guess some kind of combination of fundraising, money from government, mm-hmm. and also money from foundations. might be a model that you see more and more. I mean, I'm intrigued by this group that's been set up by the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, I believe it's called ProPublica, which has raised a lot of money from foundations, and they've gone and they're hiring, like, I think 10 to 15 investigative reporters, and setting them loose on different subjects, and then we'll post the results of the investigative reporting online, and I believe they're also going to make it available to newspapers too. So I think that's, I suspect that instead of serious public affairs journalism, that you're going to see efforts like that, because until, you know, news organizations can figure out how to create some kind of a sustainable model for, you know, for serious public affairs journalism, that so far seems to have eluded us on the internet. Mm-hmm. So that's one point. Remind me, your second question was about Yahoo. Oh, Yahoo. You know, it's interesting. Yahoo. I've always wondered about what Google is going to do, because they have a huge amount of money that they've made, and obviously Google News is very popular. My sense is that they feel like they can make a lot of money just being an aggregator and having someone else pay for the accumulation of news. And so I don't see them getting into content. Now, Yahoo has gotten into content a bit. You know, they had that guy who wrote that column, The Hot Zone, where he traveled around the world and wrote a blog about, you know, what was going on in war zones. I don't know how well that did, but my sense is that a lot of these big portals prefer to be aggregators and find that to be more profitable. I do not hold myself out to be an expert on the kind of the business side here, but my sense is that these corporations, they're not public. I mean, I think one of the great things, I mean, you can get a little bit cynical about it, but I do think that one of the great things about the Washington Post, the New York Times, you know, the family ownership has made, I mean, it's not, the Post and the Times are profit-making enterprises, and they have to make money. But they're not under the same kind of profit pressures as, say, Tribune Company or Times Mirror. I guess Times Mirror was purchased by Tribune Company. So I think we do like to think that we work for some quasi-public trust that is in which there's a value, you know, there's a value to what we do that's beyond just profit making. But I would doubt. I think that if other corporate entities saw profit in, you know, covering environmental affairs seriously or covering housing or healthcare, they would be doing that. So I think really the challenge. I could conceive of being able to cover those subjects in a way that would potentially make money, but I don't think they're going to be just doing it. I guess I'm not being that articulate, but I just think that if they knew how to make money on it, they would be doing it now. They haven't figured that out yet.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there is some record of government supporting news organizations, believing that it's that their existence is crucial to the society. If you look from the Postal Act from the 1790s, that newspapers get a break on postal rates, and then antitrust legislation allowing newspapers to print together from the same, from the same common printing place. That legislation, from the 1970s. So there have, from time to time, been clear interest by the government in viewing news as something that's required from the public. Towson, and then we'll come back. Yep, in the back.
Having been an editor yourself, do you find it harder or easier to deal with your editors?
Harder. That's a great question. I guess it's interesting. I should be more tolerant because having been on the other side, but you kind of rapidly acquire the kind of the personality of like where you are, and like so. It's reporters' lots to be perpetually grousing about their editors, and so and so you tend to do that. But I sort of, on a good day, I kind of appreciate what they're up to. They're juggling a lot of different things too. You definitely, it's really valuable to have been an editor because you really have a much greater understanding of how and why decisions get made in newsrooms, which I think to reporters who have never been an editor can tend to be mysterious.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that from the early times, well, let's say when you were doing the Glendenning pension case, did lawyers come in on that? And do lawyers come in on cases now? Did the Post have lawyers come in to check things out? Is that more a pattern than it once was?
I don't think it's more a pattern than it once was. I think definitely there are a category of stories that will always be quote-unquote lawyered, stories that... Well, I guess for me recently, it's been more over the last 5 to 10 years in the national security realm.
Sure.
What secrets are we going to be prepared to publish? And then there's obviously the whole issue of confidential sources, which in that area too, which has become a minefield too, because it seems pretty clear from the way the Scooter Libby case went that. Our protections against having to reveal confidential sources are in some ways very thin right now.
Yeah, and that Wenho Lee case.
And the Wenho Lee case would be another good example. So on those types of stories, lawyers are always involved. They're a part of what we're up to.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You mean the journalist going out with the press secretary? It's interesting. I was a big fan of that show, which my wife and I watched a lot, actually before I covered the White House. I do think that you would know this better, but I think that there's a huge human dimension to kind of cover press coverage of the press relations with the White House press office, where. You're traveling with these people. You're talking with them all the time behind the scenes about what's going on. I don't think, in my experience, I know of many romances that have.
There's a very famous one.
Which one are they?
Dee Myers.
Oh, okay.
She married Todd Purdom, who was the White House correspondent for the New York Times.
Yeah, that's true.
So
I forgot about that one. I don't think I personally, you don't really engage in bartering with the press secretary over, you give me this, I give you that. You are impressing them, because the press secretary is often kind of the broker of who you can talk to. Your preference is always to be able to try to talk to people, outside of official channels. This White House, I think the Clinton White House was less disciplined in that.
There's more of a discussion of that. The gaggle would sometimes turn. There would be discussions in it about how, which is a meeting with the press in the early morning. And in the Clinton administration, it was on the record, but it was not transcribed, so it did not go anywhere within the White House. And so there were sometimes discussions, one about how something was going to be covered. And one that I remember was the week of the Monica Lewinsky case. When it broke, that Friday, Tony Blair was going to be at the White House, and a reporter, a White House correspondent, asked McCurry if there was a way of having the president answer questions about Lewinsky before that joint news session, so that it didn't turn into just a Monica session. And so McCurry said that they thought about it, but that they had tried that on a trip to Latin America where there were questions about the fundraising practices in the 1996 campaign. And to avoid having that issue dominate a joint press conference it was in Argentina, that what they would do was have him answer questions. And so McCurry pointed out that it made no difference that reporters asked the questions anyway. And he said that that's what would happen with the Blair situation. But they discussed it. And that discussion was nowhere in the press. I mean, it was just something. And there were several occasions in which that kind of discussion would take place. But it was the terms of news where reporters would say, the president is not meeting with reporters today, yet something important took place overnight, and usually in this circumstance we see the president, and so that the president would meet with reporters sometime during the day. So you have that kind of negotiation.
I think those kinds of negotiations still go on. I don't think they go on at the gaggle. The gaggle has evolved into a more formal institution than I think it was originally intended to. And in fact, there also is now a transcript. They don't send it out, but
they send it out all throughout the administration.
Right, through the White House. So
yeah. So it becomes a tool for them to tell everybody in the administration what they're talking about and what they're not talking about. And so I know people have told me they found it useful to read it because they know what they can discuss and what they can't. But that was not done. And you had some frank discussions in those gaggles in the Clinton years.
The one thing actually about the West Wing that I think is like totally crazy is what were you saying?
I was going to say what it looks like. The White House looks like
right. Well,
the White House doesn't. Look
the White
like
House
that.
Doesn't look like that one, but also just like kind of this notion of kind of commotion and like people running into each other's offices all the time, and it's crazy.
Yeah, and on the hallways, right? There's just no way they're in those hallways. Towson. Yep, I'm back.
When President Clinton get upset about the stories column about the White House, do they have any influence on future stories and how they are covered?
Can you say it again? Because the first part we couldn't hear.
When a president and others below him get upset about stories or columns about the White House, do they have any influence on future stories or how they are covered?
Well, the big tool that presidents and their aides have is to withhold information, to withhold interviews, to not cooperate with you on stories. And I think, I, you know, I think that by and large, I don't know, I haven't done a systematic study of this, but I don't think it's like a particular surprise that, you know, Fox News gets most of the interviews with the president. I mean, have you done a study about that? I'm comparing Fox News versus ABC or uh-huh. CNN, or I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They see Fox News as a more sympathetic outlet, well, whether fairly or not, and so.
But it's also dealing with it's their constituents,
right.
And so they do a lot of things where they decide who their constituents are. And sometimes it's outside of a norm. Like, say, in 2004, the president did interviews with Runner's World, with golf, you know, golf right. something or other. And so he had all of these targeted, these various groups.
Right.
So they look kind of broadly at that.
Right. But you know, I think one thing that you kind of look, I think that one thing that you kind of quickly learn, I mean, we're all human beings. Who cover the White House, and so you don't, you know, there's a part of you as a human being that, you know, in some ways you don't want to, you know, get on someone's bad side. But I mean, we're sort of professionals, and I think at the end of the day, you kind of realize that, you know, you got to write the way things you see it, yeah. whether, you know, let the chips fall where they may, and. I mean, one of the benefits, I mean, I think that one of the benefits for reporters of a White House that does not basically cooperate mm-hmm. with stories is that they lose leverage. I mean, I think that you know, a perfect example of that in the first term was with my colleague Dana Milbank, mm-hmm. who they did not like, and he was, he was very independent-minded, you know, terrific reporter, had a lot of, you know, had a great observed eye of what's going on with things, and, you know, what were they going to do, threaten not to talk to him? They never talked to him anyway. So that's not quite
right.
true. I mean, because Dana did have some sources. As you say, he worked around the edges, but the point is that I think the lesson you have is that it's one of the most important things that you bring to the job is kind of a tough-mindedness of analysis of, mm-hmm. and that, you know, whether or not people talk to you can't really be the important determinant in what uh-huh. you write.
One of the things that the White House has done in the second term, and it's they're making use of the internet, are all the emails that they send out. And one set of emails are setting the record straight.
Yes.
Where they tackle reporters for stories they don't like.
That's happened to me once or twice.
what happens when they pick you out for one of those?
You know, it's really, I don't know, that it's really kind of funny. It's I don't think it particularly hurts reporters. It probably makes them, their esteem rise, or their editors and their colleagues, that they're being attacked by the White House. I mean, I think the truth is that you ought to try to be accurate and uh-huh. fair, whether or not they like it or not, and not worry about them attacking you. And I think that's the approach that, you know, that I would take, that Peter would take. I mean, I think that it's very weird on the it's interesting kind of what interests the White House and what they respond to. I wrote a preview piece about the president's Middle East trip, in which I basically said the president has been scaling back expectations about what could be accomplished. Mm-hmm. That he had once said early in his term that he wanted to see a Palestinian state by the end of his term, but now he was saying that he wanted to define what a Palestinian state would look like, even though such a state might not actually come into being before the end of his term. And so I wrote in my story that they were scaling back the expectations, and the White House press office was very upset. They said, no, he's been doing nothing of the kind. He's always been clear that he wants to define a Palestinian state. So, in other words, if you think about it, what they're basically saying is he had set low expectations to begin with. And so how could they be changing? It was kind of a weird thing that they got upset about. And I suppose in like a technical way, maybe I got the timing a little bit wrong about it. But basically, if you look over the course of the administration, they've been downplaying what they think they can accomplish.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Larry, you had a question.
Yeah, I was just going to, this is actually, you have to give a chance to help all my students right now. 10 weeks from today, the students are going to be turning in a paper on criteria that we're going to develop throughout the course on first shots at the legacy of the Bush presidency. Now, I wonder, you know, you're in this unique position at the Washington Post, reporter in the White House. Give us a couple of handles on what is your assessment of the Bush presidency's relationship with the White House press corps over the last 7 years, and how might you begin to think about that in terms of the future of assessing this president, but more important also, if you have any interesting historical comparisons with previous administrations as well.
Sure. You mean the question is like what do you think the legacy of the Bush administration will be with the press?
Yeah. What kind of handles might you want to give us there? Think about as we begin our 10-week study of the Bush presidency and the press.
Right.
I'm asking you to think of your right. position of covering
the administration. Well, one question that I have. I mean, the thing that immediately comes to mind in response to your question, and again, Martha, you might have a better sense of this than I do. One question that I have is whether the kind of aggressive effort to kind of control and shape the news paid off. Now, what do I mean by that? I didn't cover Reagan. I didn't cover Clinton. My sense of those administrations from talking to colleagues who did cover it mm-hmm. was that with the White House press corps, especially sort of the elite White House press corps in terms of, you know, the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, you know, the major papers, major news, major networks and so forth, my sense is that the previous administrations were more relaxed about having interaction between senior substantive aides and reporters. So, therefore, I suspect, although I can't, I think it's something that would be worth querying, did James Baker, did Leon Panetta, did John Podesta, what was their relationship with the press, how is it qualitatively different than, say, with Josh Bolton or Andy Card?
Mm-hmm. They talked all the time.
They did.
Yeah.
The people from the previous
Baker,
administrations.
Yeah, Baker did all the time.
I mean, Baker, this is based on my conversations, you know, with people like Lou Cannon and David Hoffman who covered it. You know, he really saw the press as a constituency mm-hmm. to be wooed and to be... And he gave the reporters a lot of access mm-hmm. into his, now some of it was off the record, some of it was yeah. was background, but you know, he was much more, I think, aggressive than say Card or Bolton is about personally trying to shape the coverage. And you know, I tend to think, and again, this is, I think, something that's worth exploring, in terms of, like, I tend to think that may have paid off for those administrations. Because I think that for reporters, the people, whether fairly or not fairly, I'm just trying to speak from this analytically, I think people in those positions are seen as more credible mm-hmm. Imparters of information. They're the ones who are... Mm-hmm. you know, really at the table making decisions. So, you know, if you're talking to Josh Bolton or Jim Baker or to Andy Card that, I think, is probably more credible to a reporter than if you're talking to mm-hmm. Tony Snow or to, mm-hmm. you know, Mike McCurry. Mm-hmm. Now, McCurry, I think, was a little bit different. I got the sense from, again, talking to my colleagues, that McCurry was seen as more of a player than some of the White House, than the current White House press secretaries.
Yeah, there's a, you know, there tends to be a difference between Democrats and Republicans as to where they put the focus of their explanatory function. But Baker said that he felt that it was very much a part of his role to explain to reporters what policy was, because reporters were generalists, and that it was in all of their interest that they understood policy. And he knew that from the start. And when he was talking to people about his job, he had notes that he wrote down from his discussions with people. And one of the notes that he had was from a discussion that he had with Dick Cheney, who had been chief of staff for President Ford. And Cheney told him to meet with the press and discuss policy with the press, but do it on background.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But I think that it's interesting because as you watch the presidential campaigns, I certainly think Hillary Clinton's campaign, I wonder how much they're watching, you know, how Bush has handled the press, and whether they see that as like a positive or negative tale. My sense is I think they like it. They like the idea of kind of stiffing the press, of tightly controlling information. But I'm not sure that in the end it really served mm-hmm. Bush that mm-hmm. well. Maybe, but I'm not sure. They've gotten pretty tough coverage mm-hmm. over the last 4 or 5 years. You know, I guess one could argue in the first 2 or 3 years, you know, maybe they got better coverage from their point of view, and maybe, you know, the press, you know, is always being criticized for, you know, what we didn't do on weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. and I'm sure we deserve some of that criticism, but I think just in the end, cumulatively, I'm not sure that the White House has been that mm-hmm. well served. At least that's a question that I would have.
Yeah, and if you look at how they worked in their relationship, it really changed. Because in the beginning of the administration, they did not seek coverage in the same ways they decided to get into it later. What they thought they could do was get into stories on their own terms, on their own timing, and with what they wanted to say. And then they found that their critics could overtake them, and so they were more willing to get into stories. But one of the things that I think they missed by having an aggressive operation where they told people what they thought was important, it was an operation that didn't listen, and so they missed a lot of things in talking to people that they could have otherwise heard. For example, in the first year, all of the problems that came up about corporate responsibility. If you look at when the issues came up, they came up at the end of the year in 2001. Say Enron, you know, collapsed then, and then WorldCom. But the president really didn't make his major Wall Street address until July. And one of the things, if you have a real dialogue going with the press can sometimes save you from mistakes. That they know the rhythms of things, especially if people have been covering several administrations.
Right. This is the point that Sapphire makes a lot about press conferences. It's sort of a discipline. It's a disciplinary function for an administration.
As long as that's the way they prepare, where they say in the Clinton administration, they would send out to the departments and agencies to find out what issues were bubbling up. And I don't think they do that in this administration. I don't think they prepare in the same way. Towson, one last question. Oh, yeah, we're fine. No question? Okay, we'll take one last one from here. Yeah.
When you were talking about your relationship between correspondence and the administration, I was wondering, separate from that, what relationship
best story out before everybody else? Would they need to work together or build sources together?
Well, you certainly don't build sources with your competitors on the beat. I have actually been very... I'm looking for the right word. I think the White House Press Corps is unusually collegial. At least I've found it to be that way. That most of the correspondents seem to like each other. They're very friendly. Within the bounds of kind of professional competition, you know, you're helpful to each other. And obviously people are very competitive and want to have scoops and want to find out things that others don't. But I've been very, I really like the other reporters a lot, by and large. And, you know, some of them are extremely knowledgeable and very generous about sharing that knowledge about things. You know, you take a guy like Mark Knoller, who, I don't know if you guys know him, he's a CBS News, longtime White House reporter. And, you know, he's really done a great service. He keeps very good statistics on presidential travel and when the president goes to different places. That the kind of information that can be quite useful on a case. He's very generous about sharing that kind of that material.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to the Ford administration.
Right. And I think you have, you know, people like Ann Compton, who's now the head of the White House Press Association, the Correspondents Association, very generous in just sharing their insights into things. So I think that's one of the nicer things about the beat. It's a very friendly beat. And also, one of the things that's nice about is that you know, it's funny, I think Ann was like one of the great White House reporters at the Post. I mean, I think that there was tension often between her and some of her colleagues at the Post because she was very aggressive in that respect, in wanting to be the one who broke the news and got the attention. I think my sense is that things are operating a little bit more collegially now. I mean, Peter and I and Michael Fletcher, our previous colleague, and Dan, very open with each other about, you know, the sources that we talk to, ideas, you know, you do this story, I'll do that story, you want to go on that trip? You know, this is a constant, very friendly flow, which just makes life a lot easier on the beat.
Thank you very much. We've held you longer.
It was fun.